All right, we are going to be in Acts. Chapter 23 is where we're at. Right? Paul has come back from his last missionary journey. He comes into Jerusalem. Everything seems to be going okay until he gets arrested. It was so bad they had to actually pick him up and carry him out of the area. He then, as he's being carried out, he tells the people, I want to stop and talk to these people. So he talks to the Jews and tells them his amazing story, but he kind of wraps it up with this idea that he was called to the Gentiles. Well, at that, they get super upset and they want him killed. So that's chapter 22, verse 22. Up to this word, they listen to him. The issue with the Gentiles. So then Paul goes in and he's talking to this Roman tribune, and come to find out, oh, we both speak Greek, and it's because we're both citizens of Rome. But where this tribune, who's got the authority, had purchased his citizenship, Paul was actually born a Roman citizen. So we find this weird situation where Paul actually has more authority than this tribune does. And so what are we going to do about all this? One of the worst parts about it is Paul's still in chains. So this is actually chapter 22, starting in verse 30. On the next day, desiring to know the real reason why he was being accused by the Jews, he unbound him and commanded the chief priests and all the council to meet. And he brought Paul down and set him before them. And looking intently at the council, Paul said, Brothers, I've lived my life before God in all good conscience up to this day. You guys remember this part of the story? We talked about this last week. The issue of conscience. How does conscience play into what Paul was doing? Well, we decided last week, he was acting according to what he actually believed. He was in good conscience. That doesn't mean he was right. It doesn't mean that he was righteous in his actions, but he was acting the way he believed that he was supposed to. So verse 2. Then the high priest Ananias commanded those who stood by him to strike him on the mouth. Then Paul said to him, God is going to strike you, you whitewashed wall. Are you sitting to judge me according to the law, and yet contrary to the law, you order me to be struck? We're going to come back to that. Verse 4. Those who stood by said, would you revile God's high priest? And Paul said, I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest. For it is written, you shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people. Now the story is going to diverge here. Paul's going to start this little mini fight. So we have the issue of Paul accuses somebody. And then the high priest... It's not the high priest. It's somebody. Those who stood by accused Paul. And then someone accuses Paul. Do you catch how that's playing out? He gets struck in the face, and so Paul accuses somebody. You whitewashed wall. You're going against, how does he put it? You're sitting to judge me according to the law, but yet contrary to the law, you order me to be struck. Why is it not according to the law or against the law that he was struck? Anybody have a footnote here? Okay, what does Deuteronomy 25 say? Oh, we're still looking. I was just filling space on the recording.
Seems like it's, you want me to read it or some?
Okay, Brad's going to go ahead and read it.
Okay, so if there is a dispute between men and they come into court and the judges decide between them, acquitting the innocent and condemning the guilty, then if the guilty man deserves to be beaten, the judge shall cause him to lie down and be beaten in his presence with a number of stripes in proportion to his offense. So it seems like the beating comes after.
Right. Is that what you were looking up?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Okay, any other footnotes? Some of the footnotes make reference to you shall love your brother as your own. It comes right before the command to love your neighbor as yourself. So Paul has both generic grounds to accuse, but he also has very specific grounds to accuse. The high priest got this out of order. You only get beat after you've been convicted, not during the trial. Okay? So what's this next accusation? Someone accuses Paul. Would you revile God's high priest? Anybody have a cross-reference to or a footnote to that one? Okay? There is a rather obscure statement. Let's see if I wrote it down. This is verse 4. The statement is, the statement is having to do with not treating God's anointed with disdain. And it's in the section of Leviticus. There's a section in Deuteronomy where it's just like random laws. There's this random law about this and a random law about this. And there's this random law about how you don't mistreat God's leaders.
Exodus 22:28 says, "You shall not revile God nor curse a ruler of your people."
Okay. What's the surrounding text? What was it? Exodus what?
It's if you lend money, Exodus 22:28. So it's again random things.
Yeah.
If you lend money, blah, blah, don't delay to offer your firstborn and your offerings.
Okay. So there's this issue of you're not supposed to mistreat God's placed authorities. Is there any other place in Scripture where that type of a law is in view? So, I don't know how you want to say it. How does that read again? Don't.
Sorry, let me get back to it.
It's not mistreat, it's...
Revile.
Revile or curse?
Do not revile God, nor curse a ruler of your people.
By the way, anybody notice the connection there? There's a connection between God and a ruler that God appoints. Has anybody recognized this throughout the Old Testament? When God was sending Moses into Egypt, he actually defined Moses' position before Pharaoh. He said, "You will be as God to them." It's in the Psalms, the person who's crying out to God is saying, basically, God, you're sitting in judgment with all of the gods. When are you going to judge rightly? And God's response is, I've called them gods. And it's this idea that the rulers of the people play a position that is God. It's not that he's actually God. He's God's direct ambassador. We see this play out in a couple of places. Specifically with David, a few times in David's life, he would not take a stand against Saul. Why? Because he understood that you don't revile God or a ruler. So he was in the cave of Adullam, and Saul comes in to relieve himself, whatever that is. And David comes in and cuts the corner of his robe off, and then Saul leaves. Do you remember David's response to that? He was a broken man. He comes running out, confessing his sin, repenting of mistreating God's ruler. David understood that you don't do this. Paul understands that also. So, when Paul is accused, what is Paul's response? "I did not know, brothers, that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'You shall not speak evil of a ruler of your people.'" Okay? He immediately is contrite. Right? He, good job, A+. What about the high priest? Paul confronts him with his sin, and what was the high priest's response? No response whatsoever. That's weird. So here's Paul in front of James. So this is two chapters ago. And James is going, you got to uphold the Jewish law. And Paul's going, "I always have." Between the two, Paul is the greater of the two. Paul then is engaging in the temple courts And he proves that he is greater than all these people who are accusing him. They're beating him and they're kicking him and they're violent against him. And while he's being carried out, he says, stop, I want to talk to these people. He proves himself the better man again. Right? Accused again, and this time before the tribune, come to find out, Paul is the better man. He's born a Roman citizen. He didn't buy it. He's now before the high priest. The high priest proves himself to be of low quality, and here's Paul of high quality. We find that Paul is in these great positions, but even Paul's testimony about himself, and it was just a chapter ago, testimony about himself is, I was chasing down people to kill him. So we see a major change happen in this man's life. Some of these things God provided, born as a Roman citizen, right? Some of these things God teaches him, right? To where before James. Some of these things God builds into him, this love for the people that he would want to speak to them on the temple court, on the temple steps. And then before the high priest, the greatness of humility shown in Paul. These last two chapters reveal God's work in Paul over time. So, with that, we now do verse 6. When Paul perceived that one part were Sadducees and the other part Pharisees, he cried out in the council, brothers, I am a Pharisee, a son of Pharisees. It is with respect to the hope and the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial. And when he had said this, a dissension arose between the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The assembly was divided, for the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, nor angel, nor spirit, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. Then a great clamor arose, and some of the scribes of the Pharisees' party stood up and contended sharply. We find nothing wrong in this man. What if a spirit or an angel spoke to him? And when the dissension became violent, the tribune, afraid that Paul would be torn to pieces by them, commanded the soldiers to go down, take him away from among them by force, and bring him into the barracks. What do you guys think of that story? I think it's funny. There's one issue with historical narrative. We don't have any interpretive statements. Was this a good play? Was this Paul being manipulative? It even says specifically he noticed that it was split half and half, so he brought up an accusation that actually had not been made with the intent of causing a fight. What do you guys think about that? Nobody has a thought about it? Is that an okay thing to do?
Yes.
Okay.
It is. I think it's he did the right thing because they were walking around not... They all knew the difference they had. And yet no one was actually standing up and saying anything about it. Their reaction, I don't think, is correct. But I think the fact of walking around not having that confrontation was the problem. And he saw that.
Okay. He had experienced that for a time. He was a Pharisee.
Mark, part of witnessing is contending for the faith, and a foundational point of that is the resurrection. So it could be said that he was contending for the faith, but at the same time, from a strategic standpoint, he was taking the spotlight off himself.
Okay.
I'm not sure how different it is from when he brought up the altar to the unknown God. They did not intend that to be the Lord God, but he took something that was messed up and manipulatively used it.
Okay.
And this is maybe a similar kind of thing. It's for whatever purpose, and I don't know that it was right or wrong, but it's that same kind of seeing what's going on around you, taking a piece maybe out of context, but saying, look, okay, now that we've got it out of context, let's look at it and see if we can go somewhere with it.
Okay.
We don't have context. We really don't. So was he rabble-rousing? I think that's what most of us suspect. But I think what Aline is saying is also very possible. It's like, let me reshape the narrative here so you guys will look at something that you're not otherwise willing to look at.
Right.
And either is possible, if you just don't have enough evidence.
Right. There is not a lot of evidence. And we kind of feel bad painting Paul as anything other than wise and intentional. What we do have is what God says to him next. So verse 11, the following night the Lord stood by him and said, take courage, for as you have testified to the facts about me in Jerusalem, so you must testify also in Rome. And there's one glaring issue that stands out to me in the previous 10 verses. Jesus. Jesus seems to be missing from the discussion. Verse 11, Jesus says, you've testified about me in Jerusalem. But that statement is not in reference to the previous 10 verses. That statement's in reference to the previous two chapters. Now we have Paul, I don't know, something. It's not about Jesus all of a sudden. It's about something else. Now it could be, hey, here's a topic that I can bring up that will point to an issue that seems to be lacking in everyone's understanding so that we can get back to talking about Christ. It could be what he was doing there. But verse 11 is an interesting end to that portion of the story. And I don't know if all he's saying is, we're done, we're done. Now we can move on to Rome. Or if he's saying, you've lost courage. You were relying on something other than the truth about Christ and his work, his death, his resurrection. And you were relying on strategy or dissension or rabble-rousing. Again, we don't have a statement about it. But verse 11 does seem to be this hinge point. Stuff was happening in Jerusalem. The story's slowing down. We're supposed to be going somewhere. So verse 12. Oh, wait, by the way, the Lord stood by him. Is that everyone's translation?
Okay. Stood near Paul.
Stood near him. This is physical language. It's not an apparition or a vision. So it just could be the way that they said it, but Paul seemingly was very clear on what the message was. So verse 12. When it was day, the Jews made a plot and bound themselves by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they had killed Paul. There were more than 40 who made this conspiracy. You catch that? 40. How many people does it take to conspire and kill somebody? Apparently 40. Seems like a lot to me. By the way, they are called the Jews here, some form of Jewish leadership. By definition, they're probably not Pharisees or Sadducees or chief priests or elders. So I don't know who they are. These are random people. Verse 14. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, we have strictly bound ourselves by an oath to taste no food till we have killed Paul. Now therefore, you, along with the council, give notice to the tribune to bring him down to you, as though you were going to determine his case more exactly, and we are ready to kill him before he comes near. Now the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush, so he went and entered the barracks and told Paul. Paul called one of the centurions and said, take this young man to the tribune, for he has something to tell him. So he took him and brought him to the tribune and said, Paul the prisoner called me and asked me to bring this young man to you, as he has something to say to you. The tribune took him by the hand, and going aside, asked him privately, what is it that you have to tell me? And he said, the Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul down to the council tomorrow, as though they were going to inquire somewhat more closely about him, but do not be persuaded by them, for more than 40 of their men are lying in ambush for him, who have bound themselves to by an oath neither to eat nor drink till they have killed him. And now they are ready, waiting for your consent. So the tribune dismissed the young man, charging him, tell no one that you have informed me of these things. All right, we will continue. The story does continue going on. They're going to send him to Felix. Who's Paul's nephew? What other stories does he show up in? I don't think he shows up in any of them. Why was he there to hear a conspiracy? I don't know. How come he's not in any of Paul's ministry? You think Paul's family liked that he was Paul now instead of Saul? That he was a follower of the way instead of Judaism? You think it's possible that his nephew was one of the conspirators until he finally had a guilty conscience? Makes you wonder. Now, the Pharisees probably don't have anybody in this group because the previous day they had defended him. Do you remember what their verdict was of Paul? We find nothing wrong in this man because he could have been told by an angel or a spirit. So probably no Pharisees in the group. Could be some Sadducees in the group. Whatever it is, they're planning on doing this. They're going to try to manipulate the system to get Paul killed. This sounds like early in Paul's ministry, when the only course of action was to lower him in a basket over the wall to get him out. This seems to be Paul's story. This is how Paul does his ministry. So we continue on. Verse 23. Then he called two of the centurions and said, get ready 200 soldiers with 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go as far as Caesarea at the third hour of the night. Also provide mounts for Paul to ride and bring him safely to Felix the governor. And he wrote a letter to this effect. And we'll have the letter. What do you think of that? How many people does it take to protect Paul?
An army.
An army? Two centurions and all of the soldiers under them. I wish I knew who this tribune was. I don't know if I think I mentioned it last week. They just found archaeological evidence that this guy exists. It's this obscure random thing, and a student at Yale just published a paper, and it's widely accepted as correct. This leader, this Greek-speaking person, was around and doing things. He seemed to be a fan of Paul. He's going above and beyond to protect him, right? We're going to stop right here for a second. We're going to ask a question we asked last week. How much of this is coincidence? God told him he's going to go do all these things. In fact, we have that little reminder, you're going to go all the way to Rome. Now, it could be that God knows the beginning from the end. And he's just telling him how it's going to work out. So, by the fact that I know everything, I know you're going to make it to Rome. Is this just encouraging because he knows the facts? Or when God tells him, is he telling him, I'm going to make it to where you make it to Rome? Ever thought about the difference between those two things? Nobody's thought about it? Let's say, just for conversation's sake, Jesus came and stood by Paul and said, you are going to make it to Rome, and God is going to therefore work the situations to be absolutely certain that Paul makes it to Rome. Let's just say that that's the way it works. What all would God have to control? Because we've got this tribune, we've got a centurion with hundreds of trained Roman soldiers packing a Jew around.
Okay. With the courage to go tell the right people.
Okay, so the nephew and everybody that's been involved with the nephew in telling the story. Okay, the provisions for all this to take place. I mean, you go bigger picture, the fact that Rome is powerful enough to safely transport Paul. That's hundreds of years in the making. The fact that Felix is going to accept him and listen to what he has to say. Festus is going to listen and accept what he has to say. Paul is accepted everywhere he goes. Oh no, he's going to get shipwrecked. Actually, that's okay.
Well, even the fact that he was in prison protected him.
That's true. Being arrested and in prison protected him from being killed. So, the idea of going to Rome is, okay, granted, it could have been God in his omniscience knowing that he would make it. And he was just telling them, I think you're going to make it. Or it could be that God is actively orchestrating these events to make sure he gets to Rome. So verse 25. He, this is the tribune, wrote a letter to this effect. Claudius Lysias, to his excellency the governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and was about to be killed by them when I came upon them with the soldiers and rescued him, having learned that he was a Roman citizen. And desiring to know the charge for which they were accusing him, I brought him down to the council. I found that he was being accused about questions of their law, but charged with nothing deserving death or imprisonment. And when it was disclosed to me that there would be a plot against the man, I sent him to you at once, ordering his accusers also to state before you what they have against him. So the soldiers, according to their instructions, took Paul and brought him by night to Antipatris, and on the next day they returned to the barracks, letting the horsemen go on with him. When they had come to Caesarea and delivered the letter to the governor, they presented Paul also before him. On reading the letter, he asked what province he was from, and when he learned that he was from Cilicia, he said, I will give you a hearing when your accusers arrive, and he commanded him to be guarded in Herod's Praetorium. Okay, 5 days later, we're going to continue the story. So Paul, still being given just open access anywhere he wants to go, protected by everybody involved. What do you think about Rome's perspective on Jewish law? Like, does Rome care if a Jew blasphemes? No. Okay? Do the Jews then take the right or have the right to enforce their own law there? The reason I ask that is I think it looks a lot like in America or in, you know, Western civilization when Islam comes in and starts enforcing Sharia law.
Well, Felix is in a really tough spot here. I mean, Paul was born a Roman citizen. That means he's of the senatorial class. Not that his family has a senator, but he's of that class. It's like 5% of the Roman population. He's really high ranking. And Felix has got to protect him, but he doesn't want to incite the Jews. But he passes the buck. I mean, he's able to do that. Mm-hmm. But he can't incite the Jews, so he's going to have riots and everything else. But he must protect this guy because this guy has rights that almost nobody in the Roman Empire has. And so he's in a tough spot. And this was a great solution. Yeah, it took a lot of resources and everything else, but I have the option of getting rid of him, and I'm going to let somebody else.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, you saw just a generation before what happened when Pilate decided to just take care of himself. Things got weird quick. So yeah, we're going to ship him to Caesarea. Let the head honchos take care of him. So, could you imagine having to come to the final statement of having to say, let's say, for instance, that this person being accused was guilty, going to that final step of actually condemning a Roman citizen if they actually were guilty? That would be a huge step too. So,
and only Caesar can condemn a Roman citizen.
Yeah. So we're talking about a situation, like you said, nobody is in a spot where they want to be. You know why that's a benefit? Now he has to go to Rome.
Well, he gets to testify to Christ everywhere he does go.
Right. Right. So, as odd as it sounds, the accusations and the imprisonments are what is taking him all the way to Caesar. I still want to push this discussion. What do you guys think about, you know, there are portions of England where the cops don't even go. Because the Islamic population has so taken over, they're enforcing Sharia law within British towns. Could you imagine how messed up that would be? It's not a lot different here. The Jews have their own law, and here they are fighting about these things. And you've got a secular judge standing over them going, I don't have a clue what you're even talking about.
Well, it's weird, because they went to the authorities to have Christ crucified, But then they just stone Stephen without permission. So it's almost like they kind of look the other way. The Romans look the other way if it doesn't really affect, like you said, citizens and things like
right.
that. Like if it's just kind of the common people, maybe. I don't know. It's weird. Because they were going to stone the lady in adultery, too. And they were going to stone Christ a couple times. And that doesn't seem to matter. But then they went to the authorities to have him crucified.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Boy, how far do you go? Anybody want to stop? We can talk about New Year's or something.
I want to know if there was a big news item about 40, 50 days later that those guys starved to death.
Yeah.
Right, yeah. I was wondering about that vow also. There's other times where God would hold even sinful men to their vow. So, yeah, probably they didn't starve to death.
I just thought that was so funny.
I know.
They said strict vow.
Now, isn't that the second time that's happened? It seems like in one of his missionary journeys, a group took a vow to kill him, and they would actually chase him from town to town. Probably they didn't starve to death either.
I was going to say with no energy.
Well, I think it's ridiculous that they were trying to manipulate. We are all going to kill ourselves if you don't kill him. What?
It's not the first time. Do you remember the one and only thing Jonathan was guilty of?
Yeah.
So the Israelites have the bad guys to chase, and King Saul says, no one's going to eat until I am avenged on my enemies. Jonathan doesn't hear the command. He's walking through the woods. He finds this underground pot of honey, and he eats the honey, and it said that his eyes were enlightened, and he was energized for the battle. And by the time it was all said and done, trying to figure out, why is Israel being cursed now? Well, King Saul, it's got to be somebody else. We're going to cast lots between this half of the people and this half of the people. So it's this half. And then this half and this half. And it finally comes down between he and Jonathan. God is actually guiding the casting of the lot, and God identifies Jonathan as a vow breaker. And he is held accountable for the breaking of a vow he didn't even know he was under. So the whole idea of a vow, God takes very seriously. Does he still take it that seriously? Any thoughts on that?
I think so. We don't.
We don't take vows very seriously, which I don't think they do either. They said, what kind of idiot would go, I'm going to starve to death before this guy dies. So
I think they just really thought that that guy would be manipulated into killing Saul right then. They must have had a low view of him. If my kid
Probably.
Came to me and said, I'm not going to eat till you give me a car.
Saving money. Thank you.
You picked the wrong person to mess with.
What do you guys think about vows?
I'll hold yours to you. Thank
That's
you.
Right. I have made one vow that I'm absolutely certain of. What does the New Testament say about vows? To the point that don't even take a vow. Be of the kind of character that if you say yes, that's a yes. You will do everything that you say. If you say no, you are not going to do that. That's the kind of character you should have. So who's holding you to the vow now?
Christ within you.
That's right, the Spirit of Christ within you. I don't know of any examples of him killing somebody. But I think God still counts vows as very important. Yeah.
General terms.
Yep. Okay. Anything else while we're there? Okay. I guess we can continue. After 5 days, the high priest Ananias came down with some elders and a spokesman, one Tertullus. They laid before the governor their case against Paul, and when he had been summoned, Tertullus began to accuse him, saying, since Through you we enjoy much peace, and since by your foresight, most excellent Felix, reforms are being made for this nation. In every way and everywhere, we accept this with all gratitude. But to detain you no further, I beg you in your kindness to hear us briefly. For we have found this man a plague, one who stirs up riots among all the Jews throughout the world and is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. He even tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to find out from him about everything of which we accuse him. But how many of those accusations were correct? Does he stir up riots?
Riots are stirred up. But he's not, except for before the high priest there, when he set the one party against the other, we don't see him as being the instigator.
He's an instigator of small riots. So not directly, but it could look like it. It could look like it. Okay. He is a ringleader of the sect of the Nazarenes. Is that correct? Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, the way you put it, it sounds like they're a gang, but yeah, he kind of is. He tried to profane the temple, but we seized him. What was that in reference to?
They're thinking that he brought a Gentile into the temple.
Okay, so that was just, a chapter ago, chapter and a half ago. Was that correct? You guys remember what the temple looks like? You have the temple on the inside, which it's not a box, but it's easier to draw. And then you get this huge courtyard outside. He definitely had Greeks out here, but Greeks are allowed out here. In fact, they have the dividing wall of separation that went all the way around the whole temple to keep Gentiles out. People were allowed in here. Had he profaned the temple? No, he had not taken anyone in here. Had he taken somebody in the temple courts? Well, probably, yeah. So did it look like he was trying to profane the temple? Well, maybe.
It's like twisting it to make it sound like you wanted to.
Right. How much of that stuff does Felix care about?
Felix wants to keep the peace. That's all he cares about.
Really, the only one he cares about is the riots. If we can keep the riots from happening, we can move on with this. So, verse 9. The Jews also joined in the charge, affirming all these things were so. We have this weird thing. If that's true, we have something strange happen that hasn't happened before, and that's agreement. How many times have we tried accusing somebody, but the accusations don't match? The testimonies disagree with one another. Like when Jesus was in front of the high priest, and these accusations were coming, and the testimonies didn't agree. If you guys are lying anyway, why not conspire to lie? Oh, it's crazy. They're not even good at lying. Okay. Verse 10, when the governor had nodded to him to speak, Paul replied, knowing that for many years you have been a judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense. You can verify that it is not more than 12 days since I went up to worship in Jerusalem, and they did not find me disputing with anyone or stirring up a crowd, either in the temple or in the synagogues or in the city. Neither can they prove to you what they now bring up against me. But this I confess to you, that according to the way, which they call a sect, I worship the God of our fathers, believing everything laid down by the law and written in the prophets, having a hope in God, which these men themselves accept, that there will be a resurrection of both the just and the unjust. So I always take pains to have a clear conscience toward both God and man. Now several years I came to bring alms to my nation and to present offerings. While I was doing this, they found me purified in the temple without any crowd or tumult. But some Jews from Asia, they ought to be here before you to make an accusation. They should have, or should they have anything against me? Or else, lest these men themselves say what wrongdoing they found when I stood before the council. Other than this one thing that I cried out while standing among them, it is with respect to the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you this day. He's willing to admit, maybe he shouldn't have said that. Maybe he did start a riot. Willingly. Maybe. Okay? What do you think of his defense? Does it sound like we're buttering Festus up? Or Felix up? That's the second time somebody's gone, "You're amazing." That's how they started it. "Your peace and your foresight, most excellent Felix," right? That was verse 2. And then Paul gets his chance. "You're amazing. Knowing that for years now you've been judge over this nation, I cheerfully make my defense." Okay? We find in Paul that he is showing respect to a God-appointed position that is outside of the Jewish nation.
From where he, we also saw him repent for not doing that.
Right? Right? He repents for mistreating leadership within his community. I think they just finished. Okay, we covered like tons of stuff today. In this historical narrative, there's one primary theme that covers through all of this. God is making this happen. Over and over and over and over again, God's authority is stepping in and making sure this takes place. And Paul, how many people is he going to share the gospel with by the time he gets to Caesar and talks to him about God? It's crazy how God is making this happen. That seems to be the primary purpose of the last few chapters of Acts. Seeing God's work through people in real time. Okay, we're going to close. Dear God, I thank you for your word, that we get to study it, that we get to look at it and be amazed at how you work. I thank you for the truths here, for the humor, for the things that we get to see that just show that you love helping your people. And I pray that you'd be with us in the upcoming week to guide and to lead us. And I pray in Jesus' name, amen.